This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. On this segment of the program, we'll be talking about some of the recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions. I think you might find this very interesting. There are some very significant cases that my guests will be talking about. And my guests are Myron Moskovitz, constitutional law professor at Golden Gate University School of Law, Jeffrey Hayden, a certified specialist and the chair of the Commission on Criminal Law of the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, and Stephen Mayer, a specialist in appellate law, certified by the Board of Legal Specialization, and a partner in the national law firm of Arnold & Porter. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, which certifies the following fields of law: appellate law, bankruptcy law, criminal law, estate planning, trust and probate law, family law, franchise and distribution law, immigration and nationality law, taxation law, workers' compensation law, legal malpractice law, and admiralty and maritime law. Additional funding is provided by the Family Law Section of the State Bar and by the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us.
Nice to be here.
Really nice to have you here. Myron, if you would, there's a very important case, United States versus Jones, involving GPS devices. That were, one of which was placed under a vehicle of someone who was suspected of being a drug dealer. I wonder if you would start with us on this case.
Sure. Yeah, this is a case from the United States Supreme Court that just came down earlier this year, a very recent case. What happened here is police in District of Columbia suspected Jones, who ran a nightclub, of trafficking in drugs. So they applied for a search warrant to attach a electronic tracking device on his car, Jeep Cherokee. So they are allowed to attach this thing under the car, and what it did was record the location of the car wherever it went. It was on there for 28 days, and during that 28 days, it showed that it went to a stash house. And the evidence that the car went to the stash house was used at...
This is where the marijuana was.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. That's where the... it was cocaine.
Cocaine. Mm-hmm.
That evidence came in. It was used to convict him by the jury. Jones had filed a motion to suppress the evidence with the trial court judge, claiming that it was the product of an unreasonable search or seizure under the Fourth Amendment. What the trial judge did was seemed to be the right thing at the time. The judge said, look, there's two things that happened here. They attached the device, and then they turned the device on to show the location of the car. And the trial judge said neither of those things were searches. And, of course, if they're not searches, they don't have to be justified by anything, probable cause or anything, because the Fourth Amendment prohibits unreasonable searches. If it's not a search, it doesn't matter. The attachment of the device wasn't a search, even though it was a trespass on the car. It was the property of Jones' wife. Because it didn't intrude on any reasonable expectation of privacy. Now, that language, justifiable expectation of privacy, came from an earlier case, U.S. v. Katz, from the U.S. Supreme Court, where the court said that's the definition of search, when it intrudes on privacy. It's not trespass. Katz involved a man going into a public phone booth, making a call, arranging some gambling, illegal gambling, and the cops had attached a bug to the phone. Well, they hadn't trespassed because it was a public phone booth. Katz didn't own the phone. And under prior cases, it looked like a search, but the court said it looked like it wasn't a search because they hadn't trespassed. But the court said we adopt the new test for the definition of search. When they intrude on the privacy of your telephone conversation, that's a search. Mm-hmm. So the trial judge in Jones said it's not a search to attach it onto your car because the underside of your car is not private. You drive it around in public. There's no books or papers there or diaries. It's just a underside of a car, you know, that catches grease. So it's not a search. And then the use of the device through the GPS to determine where you are, the judge said that's not private either because where you drive around in public can be seen by anybody, including the police. So if they followed him for 28 days, that wouldn't be a search. So
followed him in a car or
a car or an airplane. That wouldn't be a search. Yeah. So just using the device to get that information wasn't a search. Mm-hmm. So it looks like, based on past law, the trial judge was correct in holding neither of these things are searches, and therefore you lose the motion, all right? Case goes up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and there's three opinions. It's 4-1-4. The lead opinion by Justice Scalia.
When you say 4-1-4, four justices, one way, one justice another, and four other justices another way. Is that right?
Right. Okay. All right. All nine of them held that Jones wins, that the motion to suppress should be granted. Mm-hmm. But they have different reasoning in these three opinions. Justice Scalia writes the lead opinion for four of the justices, saying the attachment of the device to the underside of the car was a search. And he says, okay, it wasn't an intrusion on privacy, but that's not the only test. There's another test, trespass. Mm-hmm. And he says, look, you know, Scalia is a noted originalist. So he goes back to the intent of the framers of the Fourth Amendment and says, based on his historical research, they intended the word search under the Fourth Amendment to include a trespass on your personal property or real property, even if it's not an intrusion on privacy. Something new, something novel. He says it's not novel, but it really is. And he says, so there's now two tests. There's two ways you can get a search. One is by an intrusion on privacy, and the other is by a simple trespass, even if it's not an intrusion on privacy.
And the basic thing is, what he's saying is the law enforcement officers had no legal right to attach that GPS device to the car.
Sort of. He kind of, they don't get into that. There might have been a legal right, there might have been probable cause to do it, but he says that's not before us, so we don't have to decide
that.
Interesting.
Okay.
So there's nothing novel about that part of the opinion. It's this definition of search that is so unusual. Justice Sotomayor concurs, and she says, I agree, that was a search, but the surveillance was also a search. And Scalia didn't deal with that because he didn't have to. And she writes a very interesting opinion saying that, look, traditionally, following a car, watching a car is not a search. But the whole game has changed with these new electronic devices because following a car for 28 days is just too costly for most police departments. Mm-hmm. It may not be a search, but they're not going to do it for economic reasons. But with these new devices, you can go to Radio Shack and buy one of these things for a couple $100, stick it in there, and then monitor it. It costs almost nothing. So this is a new threat to our privacy, to have ongoing, long-term monitoring of our movements in public. And maybe we should consider that to be a search because of these new devices. And then she alludes to other devices like cell phones and laptops and new ways of tracking what people do that weren't considered searches before, but we should reexamine that whole thing. Then there's a third opinion by Justice Alito, joined by three other judges, basically taking on Scalia and saying this new notion that a trespass is a search is just wrong. It's just totally inconsistent with our prior cases. It's going to be difficult to apply, and we just shouldn't go down that road. But but he also agrees that these new sophisticated devices change the whole way the court should be looking at the definition of search. So the all nine justices agree, and this is very novel, very earth-shaking in a way, that the whole game plan for how the courts are going to look at these new electronic devices is going to change. This was kind of signaled a couple years ago with a decision from the Supreme Court that Scalia wrote involving a thermal imager that the cops were using.
Feeling the heat from...
Detecting the heat from a house.
A marijuana growing house?
Yeah, because in order to grow marijuana in a house, you need more light, more heat.
Yeah.
The house is going to emit more excess heat than a normal house. And even though if a cop were walking by and just feeling more heat, that wouldn't be a search.
Mm-hmm.
Scalia held that using an electronic device to detect it, that's a search because it's something novel. It's something you can't detect.
So where did they place that electronic device compared to that house? Where did they put it?
It was just outside. It didn't touch the house.
Didn't touch the house?
No.
It was on public property,
yeah.
And it could feel the heat.
It could feel the heat, and Scalia said it can pick up things that are private in the house.
Mm-hmm.
Like if the lady in the house is taking a shower, you can't see her, but you would know she's taking a shower by the heat.
And so that is now, wait a minute, that's considered a search,
yeah,
or not?
Because it could.
But
not
there was no trespass
there.
Because
what? What's
there
the...
There's no trespass there, right?
There's no trespass.
There's no trespass.
But don't you need a search warrant even to do that with this heat-seeking device? Or do you?
You do now because it's a search.
Okay, all right.
But if it's just a cop walking by picking up
the
heat,
yeah.
It's not a search.
Sure.
You don't need a warrant. You don't need probable cause.
Well, let me ask you this. With the marijuana grow houses, where there's a lot of heat being generated in the house, because that's how you grow marijuana.
Right.
And officers sometimes from the sidewalks can smell the marijuana from a house. What if you have a situation where they have one of these trained dog sniffing narcotics detection dogs, and they bring the dog. Let's say the officer can't smell the marijuana from the sidewalk, and they bring the dog up onto the front porch, and the dog indicates there's something going on in there, such as growing marijuana. Do they need a search warrant for that?
I don't know. It's a difficult question. certainly, if the cop himself could smell it with his own nose, that's not a problem.
He
wouldn't need a warrant.
Even if the cop walks out into the front porch,
is that okay?
That's
it's
okay.
Probably okay because we don't have a justifiable expectation of privacy vis-a-vis people walking up on our porch because the mailman does it, the milkman does it.
If your client is the, let's say, the renter or owner of that house and the cop takes the dog in the backside, in the backyard, to smell, what would you say about that?
First, that issue is pending before the Supreme Court. Right now, in the case of Florida versus Jardines, the very question, bringing a dope-sniffing dog to the front door to see if they could smell marijuana inside where the police officers could not.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a search?
So that's the issue at the front door. Okay.
That's the issue right there. The back door, I think I would feel that that's an easier one for me to win.
You think that's a trespass?
I think that's much more of a trespass. It's not held out to the public.
Right.
But... if this house is freestanding on a street corner, one side of the house on one street, one on the other, people might walk up to the wrong door, nothing's fenced in, it may take us a different direction than if you have a traditional suburban house with a picket fence in front, the mailbox is outside for all to see, people don't normally walk through that fence to go to the front door. It's starting to look more and more like that's going to be a search and a trespass. But this whole issue is before the Supreme Court now. And I think the answer may be different after Jones, given that trespass is now a factor in what they're considering, if that is the new doctrine. And they followed Justice Scalia, who said, look, we never abandoned trespass. This prospect of legitimate expectation of privacy, this is a principle we've added to trespass. It's time we take a look at it again. It never went away.
Well, let me throw
something
out.
There's another problem with the dog I got to mention.
That, all right, okay.
The Supreme Court had a case where they brought a drug-smelling dog to an airport to sniff luggage, and the dog detected.
I don't see anything wrong with that. Do you?
Well, no. The court emphasized that this dog could smell only illegal drugs.
Mm-hmm.
It couldn't smell anything, any medication or anything else,
or perfume.
So,
or whatever,
if that's the case with your dog, that's going to play a role here because the dog can't detect anything that's private that's legal.
Yeah.
He's trained only to detect illegal stuff.
That's interesting.
You know, if you were cynical, you could think that the results in these cases really turn on the degree to which the court or the members of the court can perceive themselves as potential defendants. I mean, the oral argument in this case turned on the Chief Justice's question to the government's lawyer, who said he was asked whether the Fourth Amendment would permit the government to follow Supreme Court justices around for a month. And the Solicitor General said, yes, it would, without any sort of warrant at all. And at that point, it seems to me the government lost the case because the court was incredulous at the response.
Yeah. Wow.
So it sounds like from what Jeff and Myron are saying, that whether the Fourth Amendment applies to a particular search, say, around a house, will depend on whether it's a dwelling that your typical apartment owner or renter lives in, as opposed to a nice suburban house that members of the court may inhabit.
Very interesting. Let me do this, because Jeff, go ahead quickly, but I want you to come to the Prop 8 case, the decision, you know, because I think what unfortunately we've done here, or I've done in inviting you, this is a four-hour program, and we only have 1 hour, and it's already 16 minutes after the
beginning. Well, you invited three lawyers.
I know. What'd you expect? I know. I should have known better, shouldn't I? Jeff,
with
please.
Three of us, it could have been 4 days. One thing that Jones also brought to mind, I'm looking at the one justice opinion standalone and talking about the new age with electronic devices.
This is Sotomayor? The one justice? Is that who you're referring to?
Yes.
Yeah, Sonia Sotomayor. Okay.
And I think that gives us pause to look back 13 months ago at the decision of the California Supreme Court, which cast aside arguments in that very direction that had been brought up by lower courts in deciding People versus Diaz. People versus Diaz involved the search of a cell phone. And it was on the person when he was arrested. They didn't get what they wanted from a confession. Some 90 minutes later, they went back and decided, let's go look into the phone, which they did. They turned it on. There may or may not have been a password. And they didn't feel that was a problem because it was with them when he was arrested, and didn't think that it being an electronic device with vast memory, ability to recall, should have made it treated any differently. And now
they said it was like a wallet. But it's not, or an address.
No, it's not like a wallet, certainly.
It's enormous.
Yeah.
You could have thousands of
With that in mind, I think we may be reaching a point where this U.S. Supreme Court and the California Supreme Court are parting company, and eventually the issue that was brought up originally in Diaz may be revisited.
So you're saying in the Diaz case, the California Supreme Court case, the decision was that was not a Fourth Amendment violation. Is that right?
They felt it was not. It was on him when he was arrested. Therefore, fair game. We have it for all purposes.
And you believe that that's still California law at this point?
At this point, I believe it's still California law until the United States Supreme Court sends direction otherwise.
Interesting. All right. Let's talk a little bit, since obviously the Prop 8 decision and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal has come down. What comments do you want to make about this? Steve?
Okay.
Steve, what comments do you want to make about this?
Interesting thing about the case is how narrow it is. Judge Reinhardt, who wrote the majority opinion, is characterized often as the last of the great judicial liberals. Mm. In this case, however, he took a very narrow route. What the court said was, a 2-to-1 vote, was that because California had given same-sex couples the constitutional right to marry under the state constitution, and B, given same-sex couples all the incidents of marriage through domestic partnership, there was no rational basis for the state to turn around and take the marriage right away. He purposely did not decide the broader issue of whether, absent those two prerequisites, same-sex couples have a constitutional right under the federal constitution to marry. What he tried to do was track Justice Kennedy's prior decision in a case called Romer versus Evans, and which had held that the state couldn't take away the ability of local governments to pass anti-discrimination ordinances protecting same-sex people. So that what Judge Reinhardt tried to do in this case was map the Prop 8 decision on Lawrence versus Texas in the hope of either persuading the court to deny review, or if they grant review, to persuade Justice Kennedy, who presumably will cast the deciding vote in the case, to perceive that Perry versus Brown is really Romer versus Evans revisited.
Perry versus Brown is the name of the prop.
It is the title
of the Prop 8 case.
Yeah.
Could you clarify this for us? Because I think there is possibly some confusion. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision, Justice Reinhart's decision, that is not based on constitutional law, or is it?
It is based on constitutional
law. On what provision?
It's based on the Equal Protection Clause and on the Due Process Clause.
Under the 14th Amendment?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And the theory of the decision is that having given same-sex couples all the incidents of marriage, including the right to marry, that there was no rational basis for the voters of California to take that right away.
I don't think it's going to work.
What do you mean you don't think it's
going to
work?
Well, you know, Reinhart has been reversed by the U.S. Supreme Court
many times.
Any justice in the country. And he's seen as a notable liberal, and somehow he got appointed to this panel. It was ironic to me when the proponents of Prop 8 tried to get him recuse him because his wife was involved with the ACLU. And I just thought, you know, these people aren't thinking right. They should want Reinhart on the panel. Because if by chance he rules for them, it's over.
But if he
rules against them, it's
rules
right
against
for the
proponents
Supreme Court.
Of Prop 8, you're saying.
Yeah. So anyway, he did rule against them, and he chose this narrow ground, as Steve said. And it's phony. It's just not going to work. California gave gays the right to marry for something like 145 days during this brief interim between the Supreme Court opinion and when Prop 8 got voted in. And he's using that as a hook to say that they already had the right to marry, and therefore California took it away, as Steve said, and that's a violation of equal protection. We don't have to decide whether gays have the right to marry, but they had it, and it was taken away. It's like Romer v. Evans, this Colorado case, where cities in Colorado had given gays protection against private discrimination, which the Constitution doesn't require. But then because the state took it away through the state constitution, an amendment to that, gays were treated unfairly. So Reinhart draws that analogy to Romer versus Evans.
Myron, where do you think this case is going?
I think it's going to the Supreme Court.
You think it will get to you think they will take it?
Yeah, and I think they're going to be annoyed by what Reinhart did in trying to get around their review.
So
they're not going to buy his theory, and they're going to rule on whether gay marriage is a due process and equal protection right to gay marriage.
I'm not sure how they'll
come out.
Okay,
but
okay.
I think they're going to ignore his gimmick.
The most pithy description of the possible outcome I've heard is attributed, maybe rightly or wrongly, to Professor Kathleen Sullivan, who said reportedly that Justice Kennedy would not vote to legalize gay sodomy but not gay marriage. That would be an untenable position for him to take.
Well, when Lawrence v. Texas came down,
which is the sodomy case,
Scalia wrote a dissent kind of making fun of the majority, saying, you know, where's this going, gay marriage?
Mm-hmm.
And here we are.
We are there at this point.
I think the court would have trouble justifying upholding Prop 8, the Supreme Court would, in light of what they did in these previous cases.
So you think it will go to the U.S. Supreme Court, and you think that the court will find that Prop 8's a violation of equal protection?
I really do.
Do you?
I really do. It'll be close. It'll be 5-4. I think when they think about it, that there's no way to see the outlawing of gay marriage other than as hostility to gays. I think they will.
Let me do this. I should have broken in a couple of minutes ago. My guests are really outstanding authorities on constitutional law. You just heard Professor Myron Moskovitz, constitutional law professor at Golden Gate University School of Law. Jeff Hayden is the chair of the Commission on Criminal Law of the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. He's a certified specialist in criminal law. And my third guest is Stephen Mayer, a specialist in appellate law certified by the Board of Legal Specialization. Before we end the first half hour of the program, which is the statewide version of the program, and before we take any calls, and we will take your calls, by the way, if you have a chance to listen for the full hour, whether it's in the Bay Area or on the Internet at www.kow.org. There is an interesting case that came down on Miranda the Miranda warning, and we don't have much time, and if maybe, Myron, you want to take this. It's JDB versus North Carolina. It involves a 13-year-old who's in a situation at school where he's being interrogated by a law enforcement officer while school officials are there. Can you briefly tell us what this stands for?
Yeah, it's... It involves the question of when the police have to tell someone the Miranda rights. Now, the traditional rule is there have to be two things that happen before the police have to tell him his rights. One is he's in custody, and the second is they're interrogating him, all right? There's no question they were interrogating this kid.
Yeah. They had taken parent was not there with him.
Parent wasn't with
okay.
him.
He's in this lawyer.
He's in this room with the principal and the police being interrogated about some burglaries. And the question is whether he's in custody. Now, most of the time, someone's in custody because they've been arrested. And there's a clear rule on that. You're arrested, you're in custody. It doesn't matter where you are.
Yeah.
But there's a handful of cases where there's an argument you're in custody before you're arrested. And that's the situation. This kid had not been arrested. So the courts have typically said you're in custody when you're in an interrogation-like setting, a coercive atmosphere, not actual coercion. A situation where it looks like an interrogation room. And there's an objective test for that. We don't care what this particular person actually thought. We don't care what the cops thought. We just look objectively at the situation. Well, this court in the JDB case, an opinion written by Justice Sotomayor, says you take the kid's age into account in determining whether there's custody, because most young people, kids, they have a different perception of pressure, of the type of pressure you're in when you're in the principal's office. So you take that into account. Looks like it should make a lot of sense. The dissent says you're breaking down the whole structure of how we look at custody under Miranda. If we take into account age, how about an adult's lack of intelligence, lack of education, lack of experience with the police? Do we consider those individual
factors? We've nearly run out of time. Was this a violation of Miranda by not giving him the Miranda warning?
It has to go back to the trial court to determine whether you take age and see. Yeah.
All right. It's about 7:28 at 91.7, your local public radio station. If you have some questions, comments, something you'd like to pose to my guests, as I said a few minutes ago, this probably should have been at least a 3 or 4 hour program. So maybe what we need to do, Joanne, is cancel all of the other programs for the next 2 hours.
2 days.
For the next two days. In any event, our number is 1-415-841-4134. 1-415-841-4134. If you would like to pose a question, have some comment to make, would like to talk with my guests, please join us. Whether you're in the Bay Area or you're listening on the internet at www.kalw.org, the number is 1-415-841-4134. Please join us with your questions, your comments. It always makes it that much more interesting. And for those of you who are wondering, when is the next Call a Lawyer night? It will be next week, next Wednesday, February 22nd. And the number you might want to jot down for that is 1-800-525-9917. 1-800-525-9917. What we're going to do next week, by the way, on the air, we're going to talk about the National Defense Authorization Act, which permits indefinite detention. We're going to talk about some other civil rights issues. I have some outstanding constitutional lawyers to talk about that. So we're really, I guess, on a roll here with constitutional issues, etc. So, all right, we're going to take our first call in a minute. For those of you who have joined us in the last few minutes, my guests are Stephen Mayer, a specialist in appellate law, certified by the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. He's a partner in the national law firm of Arnold and Porter. Myron Moskowitz, constitutional law professor at Golden Gate University School of Law. Jeff Hayden, a certified specialist and the chair of the Commission on Criminal Law of the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. So as soon as I find out who you are and find out, oh, there we are. We've got Sean. Sean, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yes, I'm just wondering about the rights of a child back with this high school issue What happens if there is a student or a group of students show up to a dance, they're inebriated, they do not admit to being inebriated, the campus resource officer conducts a breathalyzer, finds out they are inebriated. I'm just wondering what the legality of that is and whether or not discipline can proceed after they've been breathalyzed. And I'll take my question off the air.
That's a very good question. Jeff, what do you say about this?
You really brought up two very different points. One has to do with discipline from within the school. The other has to do with any criminal discipline. The most recent Supreme Court decisions are now pointing towards the school having a right to conduct a search if they believe that either a violation of school rules has taken place or a crime has taken place on campus. In the scenario you set forth, clearly there's reason to believe that they're under the influence of alcohol. It doesn't have to be above a set limit as it does for somebody driving. A minor under the influence of alcohol per se is both possession of alcohol itself is problematic for minors. It's mm-hmm. a violation of law. Additionally, alcohol on campus is a problem. So they probably get past that threshold. With that in mind, I think that it probably would be something that if they could pin down either legal intoxication, drunk in public requires somebody to be so impaired that they can't provide for their own safety, or if they could establish their possession reasonably close to the school or reasonably close in time, then they can proceed with a criminal prosecution. But these restraints don't apply to the school's own disciplinary system. These are Fourth Amendment issues if they were charged in a delinquency proceeding or presumably in a criminal proceeding if they were over 18.
But not in a discipline proceeding in the school.
In a discipline proceeding for school, the standards may be entirely different. They don't have the right to be completely free from search and seizure in the way you would in a criminal case.
Okay. All right. Any other comments on that?
Of course, none of it would apply at all if it were a private school. The Constitution wouldn't be implicated.
Do you agree with that?
Maybe under the California Constitution,
you agree with
the right of privacy.
I absolutely agree with that in terms of what happens at the school.
Yeah.
If a criminal prosecution follows and the police were brought in as part of that investigation and involved in the breathalyzer, then there may be a greater right of privacy that's violated. But as long as we're talking about private actors, these constitutional rights don't apply. It's only a contract between us and our government.
So if we're in a public school situation where there's a dance, do the school security people, and we're not talking about the police now, but let's say a school security person, does he or she or they have the right to give a student a breathalyzer test?
There's a narrow exception. If it's done for the purpose of criminal prosecution, it can be shown that they're acting as agents for prosecution. You reach a point where at some point there's a threshold.
But can they do it just for discipline?
Yeah, normally,
discipline, yes.
A kid goes to school. The courts have said the school is sort of taking the place of the parent, and
yeah.
they have some of the rights of the parent to control the kids, educate the kids, discipline mm-hmm. them. And that includes checking out to see if they're committing crimes. I'm not sure they could just arbitrarily pick a kid out with no reason
to
give them a breathalyzer.
Sure. But they can give a breathalyzer if they believe it.
They're not going to need probable cause.
Okay, all right.
Something
all right.
less than that.
So, Sean, I think you've gotten your answer there, I believe. All right, Julie, welcome to Your Legal Rights. Are you there, Julie?
Yes, can you hear me?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to make a comment. I know you thought you were joking when you said you should do this program for at least 3 days, but I think it's the best public service ever done on a radio, and I think it should definitely be expanded, and I would like to earmark my support of KLW for this program. And I think particularly with the threat of this new national defense thing where any one of us can be detained.
We're doing that next week, Julie.
Yes, and it should be more than a one-hour program.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the threat to all of us, anyone who goes to Occupy Wall Street who attends it, could be detained under this. And it's very frightening for what it's doing to America.
Well, please, if you would, contact Matt Martin, the manager of the station, and please tell him that you feel that your legal rights should be expanded to be at least at any one time 6 hours.
Yeah. Thank you, Ms. Finney, for calling out.
I don't know that
yeah.
Thanks, dear. Thanks, dear, for calling.
It's the best service offered to the public, and it's needed more than any service.
Julie, thank you very much. I appreciate you doing that.
Okay.
And as far as I could tell, that was not my wife who called. All right. Okay, Steve, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi there. Great program, as always. Very interesting. Just to back up here for 1 second, if anybody's ever in D.C. and can go to a Supreme Court case, I would highly, highly recommend it, because it really brings everything to light, and it's just an amazing experience. I was there, and I saw a case, and I bumped into Nina Totenberg in a hallway. I chatted with her for a little bit, and in the greenhouse even. So it was very interesting, and I followed the case afterwards when they came out with the decision. So speaking about this, would your guests please tell where they find the information on upcoming cases? Is it from SCOTUS blog? What are their very sources that we in the public are able to use to find out cases that are starting to bubble up, and then upcoming ones on the calendar also?
All right.
And the SCOTUS site, I know, is very good and has links to a lot of briefs, and people can study them too. So,
okay,
great program.
Thank you, Steve, very much.
SCOTUS stands for Supreme Court of the United States, if people don't know. There's a site run by Tom Goldstein, who's a big Supreme Court advocate. I can't remember what it's called. Is that it?
That's
yeah,
SCOTUS blog.
It's really good.
It's very good.
The guy has everything about upcoming.
You mean Google Tom Goldstein?
No, you Google SCOTUS, SCOTUS dot blog.
SCOTUS
dot
org?
Yeah. Dot blog. If you Google SCOTUS blog, you'll get it.
Yeah. SCOTUS blog.
It's really good. It's got all the upcoming cases, all the recent cases. He brings in commentary from law professors and lawyers. It's the best.
What does SCOTUS stand for?
Supreme Court of the United States.
Okay. And the actual site is www.scotusblog, all one word, .com.
Okay, all right. There you go. There you go, Steve. I hope you got that. www.scotusblog.com. Here's one. Coming back to the school situation. And by the way, for those of you who have not yet called, we're not asking for a donation, by the way, so this should be refreshing. It's 1-415-841-4134. 1-415-841-4134. If you have a question, a comment, something you'd like to share with us and those who are listening to the program. But going back to the school situation, here's a question, a couple of questions. What are the limits to students and search and seizure? And second, can school officials conduct body cavity searches? Now, that's a good one.
That's an easy one. It's going to have to be a very extreme situation to allow that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not going to be easy.
All right. Okay. Yeah.
Generally, in a situation where they want to do that, they're going to have the police on site long before they get involved in something.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about the body
yes.
cavity search.
The limits generally, though, are coming down from both state and federal decisions that are saying that if there's reasonable suspicion, it's a lower standard than it might be for an arrest.
Mm-hmm.
If there's reasonable suspicion that there's either been a crime committed or a violation of the school rules, that they can conduct a search.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to JDB real quickly.
Yes.
California law has recognized for some time now that for purposes of interrogating somebody, whether they're in custody could either be because they've been formally placed under arrest and told as much, or alternatively, if the totality of the circumstances are such that a reasonable person would not have felt free to leave.
Mm-hmm.
For
mm-hmm.
some reason, the courts have been very reluctant to apply that to the situation at schools where people are there, it's compulsory education, they're not free to leave, they're told by school officials that you are to be in the principal's office or some administrator's office, you're not free to leave. They summon the police. The police are involved with the questioning, but they haven't been placed under arrest. That brings us squarely under the facts of JDB.
Mm-hmm.
Is the end result of this litigation going to be that we look at that differently? I don't know the answer, but I would hope so.
Mm.
I would hope that that they realize, wait a minute, these kids are no more free to leave than you or I when we're sitting on the curb and it goes beyond the detention we've been moved.
Is there a disagreement of the California Supreme Court with the U.S. Supreme Court with regard to, you know, taking the JDB versus North Carolina case where this young guy, this 13-year-old child, should have been given the Miranda warning before the police questioned him? Is there a difference of California law on that?
It seems to be that they're philosophically heading in different directions. They haven't answered the exact same question.
Mm-hmm.
But in a case very, very close to this one, the Supreme Court decided earlier this year back on...
Is that the California Supreme Court?
Yes. California decided back on January 12th. You're looking at a 15-year-old that's being charged in adult court with murder. Mm-hmm. And in that case, they questioned him. He asked for his parent to be present. And that has been traditionally reviewed, although it's not quite as clear now, but it's been traditionally reviewed as equivalent to asking to have a lawyer present.
Mm-hmm.
The Supreme Court came out and said, hey, under Davis v. United States, a case that's 18 years old now, you have to be clear when you articulate your desire for a lawyer. It can't be equivocal. It can't be uncertain. And we don't see any reason to treat it any differently because this individual is 15 and not an adult. So it's not quite the same question. Mm. It's not quite whether you have to Mirandize him. This is whether he's actually invoking or not. But it seems to be that they're heading in different directions.
So you're saying then, and correct me if I'm wrong here, you're saying if that young person had said, I want my father here or I want my mother here, it doesn't matter.
Traditionally, it has mattered.
No, but under the recent decision.
The recent decision talked about whether that was an unequivocal expression for getting a lawyer. And
yeah,
in particular,
But
not apparent. But what's particularly interesting here is they said, why would we treat it any differently because he's 15 years old?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that seems to be quite opposite than JDB.
Yeah, very interesting. All right, we've got Howard. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Oh, hello. I have a question relating to smart meters and, you know, the constitutional rights that are being trampled by
this is the one where they're installing on your property at your home a smart meter that, for example, the municipal utility doesn't have to have its employee walk on your property to see your meter. They can tell this right back at the municipal utility? Is that what you're saying?
That's more or less it. It's,
now, why do you feel that's a problem, Howard?
Well, there's a number of issues. First of all, the health issue that these things are putting out high levels of electromagnetic radiation. And secondly, there's a privacy issue in which they're taking details of your usage within the home and that those can be shared with third parties or law enforcement or...
kind of details?
What details are they taking?
Well, that's the thing.
I mean, if you've got a marijuana grow house, yeah. I mean, they're going to see how much electricity.
I mean, is it just the quantity of electricity something
there's
more?
There's a whole new world coming out there in which the new. Let's say you buy a new fridge. It's going to have a chip in it that the smart meter is going to read and you know, tell you how much usage you're getting out of it. Whenever you turn a light on in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, that information will be sold to medical companies who suggest that you might have a urinary tract problem and they can sell you some medication, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's a whole, you know, your toaster, how often you use your toaster oven, how often you use a radio, how often you use a defibrillator or anything, you know.
And this is a PG&E decision, or
yes, and that's the problem: is that PG&E are installing these things against the will of people and also against local ordinances that have been passed telling them not to do this, and they're now insisting. They've now provided an opt-out option so that you can say I don't want one, but then they want you to pay for that. Even if you haven't had one installed.
Okay, but isn't there a difference between collecting the information and selling it to a third party? I mean, this just seems like, obviously, information that the utility might want for pricing purposes,
well,
which seems to me to be fine.
Yeah.
But if they turn around and sell it to the know the doctor or the drug company,
right,
or that's a real different question.
Well, that may be so. But I guess for me the primary issues are to do with the installation in the first place because of the health issues, and they're charging for doing something that they've already charged for. In other words, you've already got a regular meter installed, and they're charging you to keep that. It's okay if they put the smart meter in and you're asking them to take it out, there should be perhaps a charge for that. But they're saying they want $75 plus $10 a month for the rest of your life for just keeping your regular old
meter.
Well, there's two separate questions. I mean, the health issue is not a Fourth Amendment issue. There may be some CEQA issues,
right,
in the California Environmental Quality Act, whether they've violated that by not studying it adequately. Mm-hmm. I don't know if the FDA would get involved. It's not a drug.
Food and drug administration.
The search issue is different because,
right,
PG&E is a private company. They're not covered by the Fourth Amendment.
Right.
But California does have a privacy provision in state constitution that is not limited to government actors. So,
mm-hmm,
so there could be an issue there.
Mm-hmm.
I think it depends in large part, as Steve mentioned, on how they're using the information. I mean, they're actually selling it to individual entrepreneurs. That could be a problem.
What city are you in, Howard?
I live in Bolinas in Marin County.
Oh, do you?
Mm-hmm. So we're kind of an isolated community, and the problem is that there is no community-wide opt-out option at the moment.
It's interesting.
And even if there were, there's a number of people who don't necessarily want to do that. So you're kind of screwed one way or another, because even if you don't have one on your own house, if your neighbors have them, it's the same effect.
I'm sure PG&E is going to try to justify this as a conservation measure to find out
probably
how stuff is being used. I don't know much about that, but courts might be receptive to that.
Right. It's like congestion pricing, charging more to go over the Bay Bridge during rush hour. They might want to charge higher meter rates or usage rates when everybody uses electricity to keep the cost down.
Obviously, that's their selling point, and that's why some people are going for this stuff, because they say, this will make your life easier when it's a hot day, and everybody's turning their air conditioning on. We'll know how to, how to route the right amount of energy to you and so on. But my belief, and many of my friends and people who are concerned about these issues, is that they'll actually be selling this information to commercial companies.
Well, that's surely something that the Public Utilities Commission can regulate.
We would hope.
PG&E is a regulated business.
We would hope that it would regulate that.
Be very much in the pocket of PG&E, and really don't seem to be interested in any of the concerns that the citizens are concerned about, such as the privacy and the health and so on. They just don't seem to be concerned about those.
We're going to move on, Howard. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your comments. Very interesting. We'll see what happens in that area. Mike, welcome to Your Legal Rights. Mike, are you there?
Yeah,
hi.
It was really interesting, last caller.
Yes. What do you have? What do you have?
Well, I was interested in the whole smart meter thing. I don't know as much about it as the previous caller did, but you guys didn't really give an answer to whether or not it's constitutionally acceptable for PG&E to sell your information to a third party.
All right. There's
I think
a lot of information
that
we
it
don't
might
know.
Not be. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, we don't know what
it depends
what it is.
On the facts.
But when you speak of the Constitution, at least in the U.S. Constitution, you're talking about government action, and PG&E is a private actor, so you would probably need to find relief elsewhere. There is a greater right under the California Constitution that would apply to private actors.
Mm-hmm.
But it may not be able to get you the kind of relief you want given the amount of power that PG&E has within the state.
Well, the Privacy Amendment to the California Constitution, which was adopted in 1974, explicitly exists to protect, among other things, the use of data. So it's within one of the core values protected by the California Constitution. So if the situation that you describe really exists, there may well be a remedy either before the PUC or in court.
And how about as far as law enforcement?
What do you mean, how far as law?
Say if PG&E gave that information to law enforcement, could they use that to get a warrant to raid a marijuana house?
Okay. That's a good point.
Let's see how that happens. So all of a sudden there's a spike in your usage of your
significant spike
of
it would have
heaters
to be significant. Yes.
And small house, and if they reported that, yeah, I guess.
But the question that
I don't know
what that makes me feel though is, you're going to have that spike in power draw, whether you have it measured by a smart meter or by a regular meter. You're drawing power from PG&E. You have no expectation that PG&E is not going to know that your power usage goes up, no matter what kind of meter you have.
The interesting thing, though, with grow house situations, they will go around the meter.
That's why they burn.
And that's how they get away with it for a while without PG&E knowing what's going on. Because...
Well, so in California, medical marijuana patients, I guess, have the right to grow marijuana.
What do you say about that?
I don't know. How much can you grow? I don't.
If you're growing it for yourself, I think it's supposed to be legal. Jeff, what do you know about this?
Sure.
I know in terms of actual possession, the attempt by the courts and the legislatures to add limits have been thrown out because they contradict the measure. But it has to be for personal use, and the amount of marijuana that you would be growing in your household for your own personal use would be, I would imagine, quite a different power draw than these commercial grow houses where they have rooms, if not whole houses, devoted to growing.
Yes.
So you probably wouldn't raise that same issue.
We're going to move on. Thank you, Mike, very much for calling. Here's a question. Is there a potential constitutional law issue in the requirement in federal law for each person to purchase health insurance? Now, this is probably a program all by itself.
Yeah. That's going to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
The cases dealing with Congress's power under the Commerce Clause usually deal with Congress stopping somebody from doing something, you know, stopping from owning a gun, traveling in interstate commerce, near a schoolhouse, something like this. This is unusual because it's requiring people to do something. And that's the federal appellate courts have split on this, which is why it's probably going to the Supreme Court.
I got a couple of things for you before. We've just got a few minutes left of the program. In case you'd like to get any one of the pamphlets that the Board of Legal Specialization has or find out about a certified specialist in your area, wherever you may be in California, you can either call the statewide number for the Board of Legal Specialization, 415-538-2100, or go to the website, www.californiaspecialist.org, californiaspecialist.org. Also, if you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The Bar Association of San Francisco's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. This is a public service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, and for a referral to a lawyer, call 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. This information is brought to you by the Bar Association of San Francisco and KALW listeners like you. If you're in San Mateo County, the Bar Association there also has a lawyer referral service. That number is 650-369-4149, 650-369-4149. Every county has a Bar Association and lawyer referral service. You can call your own for a half an hour consultation. Depending on the county, it could be for half an hour a low of $25, maybe a high of $35. Let's take a couple more calls if we can. Harvey, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yes, in the same vein as the PG&E reporting that to the police, I believe the Supreme Court has ruled that police don't need a warrant to get a list of all the calls that you dial from the phone company. And the rationale for that was that you have to tell the phone company when you dial the calls. But it's not some information that anyone can – it's not public information. I can't go to the phone company and say, what calls did Joe dial? And also, if they're local calls, they're not individually itemized on your bill. Even if you're charged for local calls, I just say, you dialed 45 minutes of local calls at 2 cents a minute, and here's your charge. But most people, a lot of people, have unlimited calling, and they don't even record the local call numbers. So how can the Supreme Court justify that?
Well, it goes back to this test from the Katz case. Have they intruded on a justifiable expectation of privacy? And you've arguably given up your expectation of privacy when you dial the number and everybody in the phone company can know what number it is. The Supreme Court has even gone so far as to hold that if the police put a device on your phone that tells the police what numbers you called, that's not a search either. Now, that's going to change with this recent Jones case. The installation of the device will be a trespass.
Now, what's this Jones case? Can you tell me?
The Jones case said that installation of a GPS device on the undercarriage of a car is now a search. It's a trespass and a search. But the situation you describe where they don't do that, they just go to the phone company, phone company gives it to them, you're right. That's not a search. It doesn't have to be justified by anything.
But you might have the expectation that it's, you know, an automated, you press the buttons on your phone, it goes through the automated equipment and doesn't actually tell anyone.
Well, there's a record of it. I'm not justifying. I'm just saying this is the Supreme Court's reasoning, and I don't see any sign they're going to change that.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, thank you, Harvey, very much. Marie, you're the last caller. Go ahead. Okay. Welcome to the program.
I just wanted to say something about these PG&E smart meters.
Yeah.
The sole justification for them of PG&E is that it will allow them to track your usage to whether you're using it during peak hours or not, and you could change your usage, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And it's all bogus because I have my old bills from 1990s and 1980s, and I used to have time-of-use service, and I have a document that they could do it then without a smart meter. So this whole thing is a ruse to do something else.
What do you think they're doing?
Well, I think they're putting something in that saves them having to have somebody read the meters.
Well, I think it's a very practical thing that they're doing. They're saving.
They're not paying employees anymore. They can fire them all. Yeah. They're not lowering your charge. They're already charging you for people to read your meters. Mm-hmm. It's included in the cost. Mm-hmm. They're not rebating that cost. They're keeping it and saving the money. That's one thing. They're also making people quite sick, and no one else but PG&E can come trespass on your property and put something in that makes you sick.
Well, it may well be that there will be some lawsuits involving this thing.
Yeah, I hope there are plenty, especially when they're charging you not to have it.
Yeah.
I mean, this is really nuts, but I just want to say that the basis, the justification, is completely bogus since they had it 10, 20 years ago.
Well, thank you, Marie, very much for calling. Nice to have you listening to the program. We have, unfortunately, I'm afraid to tell you, we have essentially nearly come to the end of the program. I want to thank you gentlemen very much.
Thanks, Chuck.
If I
find out that we will be allowed to do a 3 or 4 or 5 hour radio program in the future and really, really get going on this stuff, I'll certainly let you know. Thank you very much for joining us. Myron Moskovitz, constitutional law professor at Golden Gate University School of Law in San Francisco. Great to see you, Myron.
Thanks, Chuck.
Thank you. Jeff Hayden, one of the great supporters of this radio program and this radio station. Thank you very much. Certified specialist and chair of the Commission on Criminal Law, the Board of Legal Specialization. And Steve Mayer, thank you for joining us again. Specialist in appellate law, certified by the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, partner in the national law firm of Arnold and Porter.
Thanks, Chuck.
Thank you very much. Your Legal Rights production staff members are program engineer Joanne Marr and production assistant Martin McLean. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar of California, by the Trust and Estate Section of the State Bar, the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. Next week, if you like what you've heard tonight, we're going to be doing the National Defense Authorization Act, which permits indefinite detention and other civil rights issues. It's also our Call a Lawyer night, 1-800-525-9917. Thank you very much for joining us. I'm Chuck Finney.